Thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are on a listen-only mode. During the question and answer session, if you would like to ask a question, please press star one from your phone. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the call over to Ms. Janet Kloeckner. You may begin.
Thank you. Hi, my name's Janet Kloeckner, and I'm pleased to welcome you, maybe I don't need the glasses, to the second in our series of distinguished lectures on designing disruptive learning technologies. The series is organized by the Cyber Learning and Future Learning Technologies Program Working Group, and the Cyber Learning Program itself is a joint effort of four NSF directorates, Computer and Information Sciences and Engineering, SIES, Education and Human Resources, EHR, Social, Behavioral, and Economic Sciences, SBE, and Engineering. The mission of the Cyber Learning Program is twofold. First, to imagine and anticipate the next generation of learning technologies, what those technologies might be and how to use them, the ones that will be used on a regular basis 5 or 10 or 20 years from now, in school and out of school and by people of all ages. The second part of the program's mission is to advance our understanding about how learning happens, how to foster learning, and how to assess learning, with a special focus on the learning that happens in contexts where learners are having experiences that computers make possible and where technology can collect data that could not be collected otherwise. So I am delighted today, we're all delighted today, to have as our speaker Kurt Squire, who will talk to us about the future of games for learning, and particularly some ways it's possible to foster learning with games and the challenges and the care needed to design games so that they not only engage game players over long periods of time, but they also systematically foster learning as people are playing them. Kurt comes to us from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's in the education school there in their Division of Curriculum and Instruction. He's more junior and probably has less gray hair than you would expect in a distinguished lecturer. He is, however, among the most distinguished researchers in the games and learning community. He focuses his research on the potential of video game-based technologies to make systemic change in education. Welcome, Kurt, and I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thank you. So, thanks so much for having me, and it's a real honor to be part of the series. A lot of the speakers are friends and colleagues, and so it's a really great job. So thank you, Janet. And also thank you to Elizabeth Vanderputten, one of my other program officers. I don't know if she's here, but she's funded some of this work as well. So lest I forget, thank you. So today I want to talk a little bit about what's happening in game-based learning, some of the work coming out of our lab, and to try to get people to think pretty expansively about the opportunities here, but then also be kind of sober about the realities of doing this kind of work. It's tricky work. So to give you some context, I'm in the School of Education, but I also run a lab as a part of this thing, which is the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery. It's a cutting-edge research facility designed to be one of the biggest in the Midwest. So our peer groups, we are the GLS Games Learning Society group, and it's kind of a bit odd. Our peer groups are things like systems biology, binates, epigenetics. Coffee time is oftentimes quite interesting, coffee and tea, as we try to figure out what each other does. But that's actually done by design. The idea is that these groups should work together, collaborate, bump into each other, and come up with new discoveries that would otherwise be impossible. And I'll talk a little bit about some of the ways we're trying to do that today. Our group itself is also kind of weird. We've got about 8 faculty, give or take the day and the mood of people. They want to opt in. 17 full-time game developers who've got about 120 years of experience in the commercial industry, and then 26 game researchers, again, give or take. So it's a very much a studio kind of collaborative feel nested within this science biotech research facility. Now, you might be thinking, what in the world is a fully functioning game studio doing there, and why would that be? Sang Kim was the first one who recruited us to this, and he is a former director, area director at NSF, actually. And for him, what he was interested in is making sure that a group like this has someone that is at the forefront of what kinds of technology and technological changes are happening. And to give you an example of what I mean by that, for him, as someone coming from healthcare, he was also the CIO of Eli Lilly before this, there's this thing happening with people and mobile devices where computing is becoming distributed, and this has huge implications for how we organize our IT structure, how we think about, you know, everything that we do with computing. So for him, what he was interested in, let's get a group in the middle of this that just inherently thinks this way, or that thinks in terms of games being able to do the kinds of things where we have different autonomous people being nodes in the network. This is the kind of logic that led to the breakthrough of something like Foldit, right? So people here may be familiar with Foldit. It got some headlines for the gamers playing a game where they are doing protein folding, were able to solve some scientific mysteries, to quote this headline, that had eluded scientists for decades. So the idea is that by having groups in there that are just thinking differently about technology and thinking differently about what users' roles are, that you can have transformative breakthroughs. In this case, thinking about the public as, or you know, 50,000 game players as potential scientists that can contribute to the scientific enterprise. So there's, again, just a fundamental logic. Another reason I like to joke is I think half of them think it can also make their work look cool. So we worked with John Yin, who's a virologist, and so, hey, John, this is a version of a game based on his research in virology. They're engineering viruses to be vectors for carrying drugs and therapies. So it's kind of an added benefit there. I'll talk a little bit about that. The last layer that I want to talk about gets to the kind of World of Warcraft part of the title, and that is that games are really interesting sites where you have virtual societies emerging and happening online that leave these very robust data trails. So David Krakauer, who's the current director of the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery, his kind of research mission is how do we understand information exchanges at the cellular level going all the way to the social level. He used to be the director at the Santa Fe Institute, so that hopefully will help make jog the connection here. But games are a really interesting side of this. They have this giant data exhaust, right? If I'm online clicking things, all of that is data that's available to be analyzed, and we can hopefully come up with something like a computational social sciences around that. So this is drawing from the work of my wife, Constance Steinkuhler, my co-director, who studied people playing World of Warcraft, and most people here probably know what it is, but just to jog your memory, sites where you've got 20,000 people online in a virtual environment interacting in real time. The work that she was doing was looking at what are the intellectual practices going into such communities, trying to make the case that they can be sites that are substantial and have their own cultures and their own ways of being. But part of this work actually looks not just at the game, but the things that happen around the game, so the game community. So some of this work that she looked at, were things like, what are the practices that go into the online forums? What are they talking about? And this is a paper that was presented a while ago. But just to give you a sense that there is a culture of the game that can develop ways of thinking that could be something worth studying. I can't go backwards in slides, correct? Okay. And then the key part of that we can get a data exhaust from this. So this is a slide from Ken, the VP of data at Zynga, and there are a lot of educational startups on Silicon Valley built around this idea that we can be using these data exhausts as a way to improve learning. So that's kind of what we do in our overall social context. I'll actually jump through these real quick and get to the next thing. Now, from our research on games for learning, we've come to see a general trajectory that learners go through. And this is kind of one of the threads that's going to hold this talk together. When people start coming to a game, they come as something like a newbie. So what people are learning are the kind of the basic controls and themes, kind of how do you basically play the game. And that's something that games kind of do in general. Like if you're going to play a game, whether it be chess or tic-tac-toe, you have to come to that level of understanding. What happens next is something like a competent player where you get a basic knowledge of the game system, the knowledge of the controls, the moves. Kind of if you were to take a test on chess, this would be, you know, you could kind of pay for that knowledge. Now, one of the real tricks behind this work is can you make games as you're designing games for science learning where the basic knowledge and controls are the same things that you want mastered in the domain? From there, there's something like systemic expertise, and again, this work is coming mostly from the body of work of game scholars, just studying what do people do playing World of Warcraft, what do they do playing Civilization, stuff like that. But you get to the point where people start saying, aha, I'm in a World of Warcraft group, we have four players this time instead of five, so we're all going to have to change our roles and adjust things on the fly. And at that level, you have something like a systemic expertise, where you can encounter a change in the system or a new kind of tweaking a variable, and you can start to understand and act competently with that. from there, there's an interesting thing that happens, particularly as an educator, and that's where some people become motivated to start tinkering with the system. This is where they start modding, they start changing the underlying rules. There are any number of ways you can do this, involving things from something like World of Warcraft, changing the interface. Sometimes people do their own modding. They make up their own rules for the game, like you would, say, playing Monopoly. From that, there's a trajectory where some people go on to become something like designers. They start designing their own game. When you work with kids, you see a time where they say, I like World of Warcraft, but I want it to be World of Star Wars, and so I'll start designing my own game. And that's something that we'll talk about, how do you facilitate. The last branch is that you get a group that from games become interested in something like social organizations. So they say, what I'm interested in doing is running a games group, or I'm interested in leading a guild in something like World of Warcraft. Some of the more interesting work along this, too, is what actually motivates and propels people through this. So this is building on some of Drew Davidson's work. At the beginning, a lot of it's curiosity, social participation. The research on The Sims is a really good test case where how is it that a bunch of mostly guys bought The Sims, and then within 2 to 3 years, it was a lot of the female player base was like 60-40. And in this case, it was a lot of social participation. Oh, I want to sit down and play along with someone, or I'm curious what that game that's in our house, and then pretty soon a new group of people start playing. From there, there's something called involvement, where you act, this is very tricky to get, right? This gets to where it's hard. How do you then get people to say, oh, I'm just playing this game, but now I actually care? There are a bunch of ways that this can be done, and I can talk more, not in this presentation, about that, using everything from story to character to challenge. There's a lot of different techniques that game designers use, but it's partly what you're doing. The next is something that Drew calls investment. And so how do you get people – this is for some people when games are actually no longer fun, where you're like, I'm not even know why I'm playing this, but I just am, and it's work, and I'm grinding. You're invested in it. Sometimes competition, interestingly, is the thing that gets people there, but not always. It can be also social participation. Well, something that I've done a bit of work on is when do people decide to start tinkering and changing the rules? When does a kid who's playing Civilization say, well, I'm going to start changing these variables, I don't like it? Usually it's either curiosity, they think they can make a better game, or they're literally ticked off at the game. So they're like, it stinks and it's broken. And then from there, there's a group that become inspired to start doing their own games. Now, as we talk about this, this is how I think of a general framework for thinking about games and learning, where you obviously want to be doing this basic kind of stuff, but you also want to get people – some people in some classrooms or learning environments, some of the time, moving toward this. So that, let's just say, by the time you graduate, maybe everyone has been a leader in a social organization or created something for other people to use. It does ask a lot of questions about one-size-fits-all kind of pedagogy, but in my mind, and this is like I would say anyone who's become involved in a game, most of us know that's kind of where you want to see people ending up. It's where the most meaningful stuff happens. So for the rest of the talk, what I want to do is pivot a little bit for kind of these two basic questions. How can we build games for learning in domains like science that get this kind of deep learning happening? But then also, can we build games that lead toward deep participation in science? So to reflect back on something like Fold It, which is a great game. I mean, I have not built a game that's led to discoveries of that sort, so I can't knock it in any way. But it's not a game that proposes to be teaching anyone anything about protein folding. Undoubtedly, some people learn, but it's not like the levels are scaffolded so that you start coming to basic understandings about how protein folding works. That's not what it does. It's a puzzle game that's trying to help use your data to make discoveries. Similarly, it's leading to a certain type of authentic participation, but I don't think anyone's claiming that. And although it may be true, it may be leading people to, say, go to graduate school, but it may also be attracting a lot of people who are already, say, in graduate school or in sciences. So what we're trying to do is, can we build games that maybe take a fourth grader where they are right now and then get them on a trajectory where they're more likely to develop identities and careers in science? So a couple of reasons, again, why games. So some things that they can do, so obviously real-time 3D simulation. This is from Portal. When you look at games that are in the border of science in the kind of popular sphere, you run into things like World of Goo, where, again, Drew Davidson's work argues that what's interesting about it is that physics is your friend in this game, and all of a sudden you find yourself saying, oh, I can use either understanding underlying principles of physics or things from engineering like triangulation to get ahead. That's kind of what we want to do. Now, a way that this game does it, and this is, again, where it becomes very tricky, is that there's a set of very well-ordered problems that is developed through years of playtesting and trial and error, where they say we'll start with simple challenges, it then gets into more complex challenges where you've got to bend around things and start using gravity in weird ways.
and of course they put spikes in and so on. But it's this kind of level design, which is how games in the commercial industry develop people's understanding. So clearly someone who's going to tackle this level has a more sophisticated understanding than someone who's going to do something that's kind of much smaller and you can, you know, you don't have to do this clever engineering. That's kind of the fundamentals of how games work at that basic knowledge sort of level. And what we're interested in doing, and so there are some coming from academics. This is Doug Clark's work around the game search. There are a family of games that are starting to do this, that are starting to build conceptual understanding in things like physics, which is a good thing. There's one of our earlier games, Supercharge, which tried to do a lot with visualization. So these are charged particles. You can do things like field lines. You can let people see things they couldn't ordinarily see. Along these lines, I want to talk a little bit about one of our games that does this. This is called Virulence. And this is a real-time strategy game where people are interacting with viruses, cells, trying to understand the immune system. We're working with John Yin and the systems biology group because they are designing viruses. And what they wanted to do was design a – I'll give away the trick at the end of the game because we'll see if we ever get the last chapter done. But in this game, at the end, you're a virus attacking the body, but then you realize that you're actually a vector for carrying medicine. So you're actually kind of helping the body by attacking different cells. So you're controlling the virus, trying to infect, replicate inside of the cell. So there's kind of some basic knowledge and so on how it works. I'll skip over this part, give you just a sense of kind of what the gameplay looks like. So we've been doing some research just trying to understand, again, can we use games to build this kind of basic knowledge? And we're starting to see some evidence that we can. This is a research paper, I believe, that just got accepted in Journal of Science and Education Technology, but looking at players playing with the game versus diagrams versus people playing the game, reading and the game versus diagrams in the game. We find people with the game outperform those who don't. The more recent study, which I don't have a slide for, is what we're finding, and probably the biggest variable is actually interest. So we have an interest researcher who's joined our group who's finding that interest in the underlying topic goes way up. So a lot of what's actually happening here are that people are reading it much more carefully because they actually care. So the game is presenting things in a way that does scaffold them, but a lot of it is actually building interest as well. So a lot of what we try to do and how we try to kind of rethink what impact means is trying to build games like this that are just interesting to play and that will raise people's interest. So this is a game that's on the iTunes Store right now, even in its kind of proto form. We think a lot about, can we get, say, 50,000 users or 100,000 users toward having this kind of impact? Right now we're at about 30,000 downloads, which is not as good as we want, but it's also not bad. There are a lot of teachers using it. We're starting to follow up and figure out how are teachers using it and what context and so on. So that's great, and that's kind of a good thing that we should be doing. But after that project, we stepped back and said, you know, we had this really cool opportunity being in this cutting-edge research facility. Couldn't we do something more than a virus game? Nothing wrong with a virus game, but it felt like we were missing something. So what we decided to do was contact this guy, one of our peers, Jamie Thompson, who's one of the world's leading stem cell researchers, who hated games for the longest time until his kid got addicted to RuneScape and then actually came to us and said, can you make a game that makes people love stem cells as much as my kid loves RuneScape? Like, yeah, thank you, RuneScape developers, for giving us the name. I said, yes, Jamie, we'd be willing to do that. So we started working with him, and we thought, what could be more controversial than stem cells? How about zombies and stem cells? So, and he signed off on this. He was like, no, I want a game. So in this game, what you're doing is designing and engineering tissue and an organ to try to stem the zombie apocalypse, which not coincidentally happened in his lab. It started in his lab in Madison, Wisconsin. This is his group of stem cell and tissue engineers and researchers playing the game. We worked in close consultation with them. We built stem cells. We got to the point where when they changed procedures in their lab, they had to call us and we had to change the game in real time based on new discoveries. So again, it starts in Madison, Wisconsin. And then the idea is that through different levels, you are inducing you're inducing stem cells, you're cultivating them, growing them, cultivating first cells, then tissues, then organs, and then throughout you're hopefully stemming the tide of the zombie apocalypse. So it's a puzzle game, it's meant to be broadly appealing, but then again using the zombies is kind of the hook. And as we started working with this, we got very interested, and this is a part of our NSF-supported work, interested in the idea of if we release this game out there in the wild, and let's say we do succeed in getting 200,000 people, is there a world in which we could start to understand, are people learning anything about stem cells through this? So we started working on an underlying system whereby we're taking all of the data generated by the game. So the game is online, and we get reports of everyone who plays it. And could we start to come up with what we're calling a learning telemetry, right? So taking the raw mouse clicks, coming up with an underlying logic that we can start to make a case where we understand what the people who are playing understand. To give you a sense of what this looks like, this is a bit of a file, kind of ugly. We take the individual data, we have to work with it, make it cumulative, we polish it quite a bit. And this is just a baby step. There are a bunch of other work happening on this. We're starting to do more advanced analytics with it. But one of the first things is literally just taking very simple pre and post tests and determining, can we detect patterns in play that correspond with advances in learning gains? And what we're finding, which is kind of interesting, is that the key variable seems to be the success and which type of success. And what we think what we can detect, I guess that's what they think, we're hypothesizing we can detect, is that we can tell when someone is playing purposefully and when they're just doing kind of random trial and error. And that was actually the biggest variable that contributed to gains in pre and post. And so I'll talk a little bit about that. In the findings, and this is Liz Owen's dissertation, we found that we found pre-post gains 11% average for all players. But what was interesting was that there's a significant positive correlation, I guess, with their overall success, right? So the better you did in the game, the more you tended to learn, which kind of makes sense. But the biggest finding was really here, the last cycle of success. So at the very end of the game, if you're shooting like at 100%, so you think about this curve again, you have learned what the game's teaching you. You're paying attention. You're kind of being coddled toward developing a conceptual understanding of how stem cells and tissues and organs kind of relate to one another. By that point, if you are doing well at the end, then you did well on the pre and post test. And that can be a very kind of interesting finding. Now, again, she's doing a bunch of other studies currently that's much more sophisticated with more machine learning kinds of algorithms. But this is just the kind of thing that we can do with games and learning. This is a kind of advanced, messy slide. It just kind of tries to give you a general sense of what this is a generalizable process that if we can do it for one game, we believe, or we are doing it for multiple games. So we can take your basic game design that's got a content and a task model. So we know we have a model of what the task is. We can put in and try to understand players' goals and metrics. We can get the players' actions. And we have this essentially system for tagging and doing metadata around games that we started applying across the other games in our lab to see if we can come up with a more generalizable model so that we can also start to know if a player did well on progenitor X, does that predict better success in things like virulence? Because we have a tagging system that can follow them across games. Our first way of testing this is with something called Tenacity. This is funded by the Gates Foundation. And this is an app where we're a weird, challenging task. Build a game for breath counting for kids, middle schoolers, who don't like to sit around and count their breath normally. Because this has been otherwise correlated with a lot of other positive things. So Richie Davidson, who we work with, who's famous because he's a close confidant of the Dalai Lama, has studied brain plasticity. And in particular in eighth graders, there's a sensitive period where if you practice mindfulness and breath counting, you see a bunch of other stuff you get for free. So you get concentration, grades tend to go up. It's kind of, as someone who studies learning, I say it's bizarre. You have to double check and go, really? Because, you know, transfer is notoriously hard to get, and breath counting seems to be something that gets these very unexpectedly high results. So we said, sure, we'll try to make an iPad game that does that. The idea is trying to make a playful meditation app. There's, so you get these great things where you've got a game developer with Richie Davidson, who's one of the leading neuroscientists, with Matthew Picard. We haven't had the Dalai Lama play it yet, but he's seen it. He's aware of it. Richie keeps saying, you know, if we do a good job, maybe you'll get to meet His Holiness. So that's our goal. So you can see some of the kind of research around it from their lab, and we're working closely trying to do this. So as a side note, that product and project will exist, and I'll talk a little about the research in a second, but we've also started to use it. There's probably a commercial app for adults. So something about having a design lab like this, and this gets to questions to me, hopefully for this room, around scalability and sustainability. We think we can take that app, reskin it, have it look like a koi pond, and these are images of our functioning app, which actually I have back here if anyone's curious. That would work for other audiences that we could use to hopefully kind of spin off and then fund the underlying research that we can keep working at the kind of mission-based things that we want to do, but use the money that we could use selling to kind of middle-aged people like me or us, and then use that to fund the underlying research. So you can see a couple screenshots from that. But the kind of work we're doing, which I think is another place where this field gets interesting, is doing pre- and post-tests with those eighth graders of behavioral tasks, doing fMRI, is actually looking for changes in their brain scan, which is the first time I've ever done anything like this, and I'd say it's really crazy because it's so expensive and it's so you've got to have everything lined up. I mean, I thought our work was weird. This is really weird. And then a bunch of other self-report stuff. Play the game, do the same things. But we're also able to connect through the telemetry layer. So we can say kids who played a certain kind of way had changes in the brain, in their brains of this sort. Those we're just finishing the studies now. The results will be in May and June. They're promising. Also kind of fun, the control case are Fruit Ninja and Bastion. And I'll just say, I guess this is on the internet, so watch what I say. There's some weird stuff that happens in your brain on Fruit Ninja. It's a very manic game, and you see some weird stuff. And so if nothing else, Constance, this is actually, she's leaving the research part of it, my wife. And something we thought was fun is even if we find no other results, I want to know what happens in Fruit Ninja. Anyway, so that we will know something about that. All right, so we can. Hopefully I made the argument that we can now as a field more or less build games that scaffold learning through well-graduated levels and challenges, and we can detect it more or less through gameplay. Now, there's a lot of caveats here, and that's with a more or less. This is a non-trivial set of tasks to do. Building games is hard. If you've built the games or funded someone or worked with someone, I just really want to underscore, this is not an easy thing to do. There's tens of thousands of games for entertainment that people try to build that don't get finished, that don't work, that no one likes. One of my kind of pet projects is that I did some work with Sid Meier around the Pirates franchise, and it's very interesting to see there's like 3 to 10 Pirates games released every year. Most of them aren't very good. I like Sid Meier's Pirates because it's a quasi-educational game. I got a lot out of it. But you realize that even a Pirates game is not inherently fun just because you're making a game about Pirates. You know, that one game does very well. A bunch of other games are really bad. Similarly, building interesting games that people want to play is even harder. It's a non-trivial task. They say that, you know, usually you want to do your first 2 to 5 games are going to be horrible, throw them away. How do you kind of do that and say your program officer and say, no, we're trying, we're getting to go, what we're doing, but our first games were just horrible. One of our solutions is to try to really partner closely with people. I mentioned that 120 years of experience, people who've built a lot of games. This isn't their first time, but it's a real tricky thing. Building games that are interesting, where people learn something that you want them to learn without doing more harm than good. We have built games where our initial prototypes showed that we were fostering misconceptions. There are some evolution games out there that are older, that were not funded by NSF, that actually do reinforce misconceptions. So you really do have to look, you know, are you sure that what people are learning, and are they learning things that you want them to learn? So that's even harder, right? Building interesting games where people are learning something that we really can measure reliably is also hard. So in this, one thing you get is you get these things like systemic level understandings I was mentioning. You know, how do you assess for that? I'll talk a little bit more about some of the work we're trying to do, but that's also non-trivial. Our standard assessment industry and field, you know, is built on different models that were not necessarily built to assess those kinds of things. Interestingly, I think it may be, as we move toward a digital world where you're taking a test on an iPad, I think within the build on what Jan was saying, 5-20 years, you're not going to be filling in bubbles. And I should say, by the way, we've done some work with some Scantron type companies, and as they make their digital tests, it's great. You're like, they want to keep it the same, right, paper versus digital. And you're saying, you're not going to have, you're filling in a bubble on an iPad, that makes no sense, you know? And pretty soon, you're like, why are you even only doing item selection instead of item construction? And think about all the ways you could assess. I think games, and many others do, games will be a key part of that, right? Wouldn't you, in some level, say, hey, if you play, you know, Progenitor X and do well on that last level, maybe that's a better assessment than a simple recall test and so on. So in terms of how even the modest successes we've had, this is, you know, I've been doing this 10 or 15 years. You've got 120 years of game experience. Even that project of getting game developers and grad students to work together is not inherently easy. Let's just put it that way. So our lead developer, Brian Pelletier, is our creative director. He ships, you know, tens of millions of games. And having someone who can do those things and know, like, oh, if you want this game to ship on time or if you want this to be finished and playable, which is also non-trivial for an academic, I find it helps to have someone like that around. Creating kind of culture where you have a lot of interaction across these disciplines is really key. And, of course, a sense of playfulness. So this is, again, just like this is kind of how, from my experience, how you help these things get made. One of the things I'm proudest of, I should say, is that that's an arcade machine that they built to put our games on. So those of you who have been to the Games Learning Society conference we hold may have seen it, but all of our games are on that, and it works with tokens, and Chris has played it. So if we go back to this framework, you may notice I've mostly been talking about this stuff. So that's all kind of great, but none of that should be confused, say, with actually engaging in authentic science. And so what I want to talk about next is some of our attempts to get people moving up in that quadrant. And from my experience, this is where teachers, people, social interaction, designing the environment and classroom culture becomes paramount, really. So this is a game called Citizen Science, funded originally from my career grant by Elizabeth, who I saw walked in. And this is a game where we had this idea. Could you learn science by role-playing as a scientist? And some people have done that. But we thought it would be interesting to say, what if you learn science by being a youth citizen activist who's using science? So as a way to kind of demystify science. And so we picked lake science and freshwater limnology, which arguably there's maybe too much done on it. But we thought we would try something a little bit different and try to use this as a way to engage kids, again, in doing science. So, again, one of the logic here is that if we had a game where you are, like, look, 12-year-old, you're doing science in this game, maybe it would help the teacher teaching with that game saying, you know, I could get some water kits. I could study my watershed because that's what you do in the game. So we're trying to kind of push people up that route through a game. So I'll talk a little bit more about that. So your mission is to save Lake Mendota. This is the lake that one of the lakes that the University of Wisconsin's on. There's a map of it. You get a sense of it. So downtown, it's right in downtown Madison. We worked with Steve Carpenter, who's one of the world's leading ecologists. He's been studying this lake himself for about 20 or 30 years. It's one of the most studied lakes in the world. He's one of the world's leading living ecologists as well. So you can get a sense. It's also culturally important to Madison. Some of you may have seen this picture. This is this is what it's like there right now, by the way. This is very balmy for me being down here. But in the very near future, Lake Mendota may become eutrophic. This is a picture that's much less idyllic looking. This is in the summer. And I'll give it a bit away. Most of this is caused by farm runoff upstream. So 20 years ago, dumping fertilizer into the lake has caused the lake to be so nutrient-rich that it's on the verge of becoming eutrophic. I can talk more about that. But it's an interesting test case because we can do something about it. And in fact, it turns out this lake was even worse 30 years ago. And so in this game, what you do is you travel back through time and you say, oh, it actually used to be way worse because we dumped raw sewage in there. And now at least we don't do that. But you can see this is something that is in the news. I mean, this will be on the cover of the newspaper once a year or so. So it's also an interesting case for connecting local events to classrooms. One of the key moments in the game is that a dog dies. This does happen, and dogs hasn't died yet from this, but a dog can eat blue-green algae and die. So that's kind of the beginning of the game. So what you do is you travel to 2020, where the lake is entirely unswimmable. It's horrible. And this is arguably the path we're on. And so you go forward in time, see this, and then you travel through time trying to understand what happened, collecting data, making arguments to change the outcome of the lake. Again, part of my real goal here is saying you kids all live in Madison. You're surrounded by this lake. Maybe you could develop something like a community of teachers doing lake science around this lake. The core gameplay then is going, talking to people, making observations at kind of the person-to-person level. You then collect evidence in the world, and you complete arguments. So here's an example of talking to a kid about a no-swim day. You talk to the old white guy scientist in 1967. That's the actual kind of limnology building. So that's kind of the Steve Carpenter's foreground. You have virtual testing kits, which, again, was designed to try to get teachers to think about getting more of these kinds of testing kits. As you collect data, you put them in your inventory. One of the clever things, this is actually built with Filament Games, who's an offshoot of our lab that's in Madison. They're a games company that builds a lot of these games. One of the things that kind of bothered me was that it's very adventure gamey feeling, and I wanted it to be a real simulation so that if you go back in time and change a couple variables, you would see the lake change. And they were like, if you give me $5 million, I will. Otherwise, for $200,000 budget, this is what you're getting. All right. So I thought, well, it's a very simulatable thing, right? Ecology are complex systems. And so we came up with this interesting, I think, clever design solution, which we built in a simulation in there, a model, or I guess a simulation, that you can actually change variables. So what happens if you plant buffer strips, what happens to the outcome results? And so some of our teachers have just taken this, and they can build lesson plans only around this. So some of the research we're doing is kind of the classic pre-post stuff around this. So this is a control experiment group, reading versus playing the game. But some of the work that we're doing, this is Matthew Gatos' dissertation. He's off in Singapore now. Faculty, but doing kind of a preparation for future learning. So everyone does pre-test. Some group plays the game. Some group read. Then taking a mid-test so you can test, hey, what's game versus reading? And then looking at game, then flipping it. So people played the game and then read, with the theory being if you play the game or you have an embodied experience doing lake science, you will interpret lake science. You'd be a better interpreter of lake science. And we found roughly these. What was interesting, and this is work is still kind of being, it's in revisions for the journal, but what's interesting is that We did, ran it in about six classrooms. In some of the low-performing classrooms, it went just kind of like you would expect to see, where they were going up, up, and up. But in some of the groups, the students were not able to interpret the game as well, and so there's some there's some interesting things happening here. It relates to some other work in this field has found that tools like this can actually make equity problems worse, in the sense that if you have a good teacher that knows how to teach with it, motivated kids who can make inferences successfully based on the game, they will just shoot way up, and those who may not be as well equipped may not. And we're seeing that sometimes, but not always. That's something we're trying to work through right now. All right, so that's kind of a basic example. But what does this mean when you actually bring it into things like classrooms, and how could you use it to actually go and have kids doing lake science? So at the tail end of this grant, I pulled one of our partners, a former teacher, Mark Wagler, up there. We've been working with him in part because he's literally raised Amish, and when you're doing tech workshops with teachers, it's great to have an Amish guy. He's like, "Now I'm an Amish man." He's like, "No, literally, he was raised Amish and still wears the beard." And this technology is so easy, you can use it too. And so, and actually, his sense of when you use technology and how you use it, he keeps that sort of Amish thinking of when it is used to help people and bring people together, we use it, and when not, I don't use it. So I think if I can get it past him and he's willing to use it, then we're probably doing something right. So he said, yes, absolutely, I'll do that. He teaches in this neighborhood called the Greenbush. It's like Madison's little Brooklyn, in the sense that it was historically African-American, Italian, and Jewish. And he does a lot of he's a great teacher, does a lot of neighborhood teaching. He said, yeah, what I'll do is help you build a curriculum. So this is a brief sidebar. When I started working with him, what he did is like, yeah, that stuff's great. My kids are going to design games about their neighborhood. And I said, yes, do that. Don't let me stop you. So he had kids use the same engine. And now actually we're talking about now mobile devices and things. Like he took some of the mobile devices and things we were building and had kids go off, take pictures, and then I guess I should miss the slide in there somewhere. Uploading them using an iPhone so that you can give kind of like guided tours of neighborhoods and build games on it. So here's one where the kid goes around and figure, oh, I'm Italian. I live in this neighborhood. That's not coincidental. There's that Italian deli there is there for a reason. In this case, because Italians weren't allowed to live in other sections of Madison. The KKK marched in the 60s and said, no, this is where you're staying. So the kids learned about that history and that this wasn't coincidence. So I learned a lot about institutional racism and things, which is still literally imprinted in the environment. Bufo, who's one of the older Italian gentlemen, still there, led them on tours showing what happened where the speakeasies were in the 30s and so on. And then also seeing what happened to that land and where contemporary issues of race in general. So this is kind of what he does. And we said, Mark, a couple of things. As a part of this project, they then and this is all them doing research to build their game. They held a community conference where they got everyone in town who used to live there to celebrate the town. There's now a Madison-wide Greenbush Day that they actually got. They did plans for a museum. So this is all just stuff he did kind of working with us, but it's really Mark. I mean, this is kind of him teaching as he does. Kids built games. This is a Jewish game. So 1959, you're a Jewish kid living in this neighborhood. So this is kind of a map of his game, primary documents. Their outcome of their class, and this is partly what helped me generate this model, was that they decided to draft a city council resolution, and they got Greenbush Day. So this is one of his students talking to the mayor of Madison. So as a hire, Mark, I said, Mark, can you build something? So that's great, but that's mostly Mark. I mean, I'm researching him, but that's him. Could you build something that would help us? Oh, as a side note, that Jewish game idea seems to have taken up. So the same tools has been used in New York. There's now a Jewish time jump game that's been made. So it's kind of that idea has evolved and floated. So could you do something like this in science? Could you help us build a curriculum? Work your magic, Mark. So what we came up with is a kind of basic model where you start with a first game play. So play that game, citizen science. Become introduced. Have your interest raised. Outside a game, read what is eutrophication. They watch movies. They do other things around the game. Day two, they play one of these games where you go off into the world and you look at a lake. So this is about a different lake in Madison that interestingly has an entirely different set of issues. So it's if you know the research on transfer, you want to give cases that are similar but different so that kids don't overgeneralize. So if you think if you play only citizen science, you might think every dirty lake is due to farm runoff, and that's not the case. There's a lake in Madison that is mostly due to urban issues and salt runoff, and so they play a different game. They learn about how that's dying and why. Fortunately, there's a lot of dying lakes around. And they get out in the world and they actually see, they see plants and birds and listen for indicator species and things like that. So
Interestingly, after playing this game, one of our kids, and this is the kind of thing we want to see. Now, this could be caused by several variables, I'm sure, they're interacting, but one of our kids actually spontaneously wrote a letter to the editor. This was not a class assignment, although in the class we asked them to write letters, but one of them went home and actually sent one off to the Capital Times, which I thought was great. He said, how should we save the lakes? Let's give money to schools. And I thought, well, look at this. We're doing our work here. So this is the kind of thing that we would want to see happening. On day three, on the third part of the unit, they start studying their own lake. So the teachers in one of our local districts, Verona, started studying their own lake. And interestingly, this cannot have predicted, in the citizen science game, there's a little muskrat. So one of the interesting things that the limnologist told us is that muskrats actually hurt the conditions of the lake because they eat shoreline vegetation, which increases runoff. So they're actually bad for it. A muskrat moved into their local community, and because they've been studying it, the town was actually saying, what should we do? And the kids gave a presentation saying, well, due to muskrats, we've been studying this, which is really cool. Like, that's what we want to see. And then a few of them actually started building models in Scratch and Star Logo to kind of represent ideas. So this is a case study that we're working on and getting published. But this is, to me, kind of the goldish standard of what you want to have done, especially if you can say, oh, and the kids were participating in authentic community action, using science to do stuff in the real world. So really quickly, because we're running out of time, this is great, but it's still kind of locked in school. And then the current work we're doing with NSF support is saying, can we build games where the kids in school are not playing just with kids in school, but they're playing with scientists and with other folks? So we have a version of Trails Forward. This is a very similar kind of game, but it gets into it's much more complex. It's a simulation game. Ben Shapiro, who is now at Tufts, is leading the development on this version, where you have loggers, conservationists, and developers. And one of our goals is that in northern Wisconsin, where this is a hot-button issue, these people will actually play this game and then engage in arguments, maybe like on the newspaper online about it. We have a simpler version for iPads that is also I have with me today for those who are sticking around that is tailored slightly more toward young kids. What we found, this builds on actual data. It's accurate down to about the acre. It's very complex. Building a new game about your own watershed is very tough. So we've built one on the iPad where you could build one that's realistic enough pretty quickly. We're hoping next year to have that part working. So this gets into an absurd level of detail about logging. You manage your budget. So it tells you a little bit about kind of what goes into this game. We've done some pilot work bringing it in classrooms. And one of the interesting things is when you build a game about real stuff, you do see kids instantly like going to maps and going to real things. They go back and forth from the game to real life very easily. I'll maybe skip some of the tech about how it's made, other than say that we built it this way so that scientists can build clients and bots that work with the engine. There has been one paper presented at the Ecological Society where an ecologist was using our simulation to present a paper on the American marten, a little mammal species, where the simulation was used for basic science, which is pretty cool. All right, so what we're trying to do is present new kinds of learning in play spaces. I'm running out of time, so I'm going to just fly through this really quickly to give you a sense of how we think about this. This is a game that we've been building and working on where we're using oncology and cancer detection and treatment to try to build a pro-am network around image detection and cancer treatment. This is the 20-year project. Let me just say it right now. This is the 20-year project. We're working with Rock Mackey here, who invented a company called Tomotherapy, most radiation therapy techniques, where if you're kind of using lasers to get rid of cancer, came from Rock's discoveries. Rock is a very wealthy man. He comes to work now because he's trying to cure cancer. And Joe goes, why do you keep coming to work? He's like, I'm curing cancer. Okay, fair enough. Good reason. But one of the things that frustrated him was that the ways that we I'll get to it. So what happens if you have cancer? Well, you have symptoms. You go through a process of imaging, diagnosis, and treatment. As Rock says, you either cut it out, poison it, or burn it. Rock's a burner person. So imaging, you get a series of images. These are CT scans, kind of pictures of the body. This is from the top. And then you get a diagnosis. So you circle where you believe there's anomalies. You do this contouring. There's a bunch of research on this. It turns out that there is not universal agreement about how you do this. So in the case of breast cancer, there's about 17.5% variation. If you line up five different doctors, you're going to get about this much variation about where they think the cancer is. Lung cancer, it's about a factor of two. Cervical cancer, it's 3 to 4 times. So this is scary, and this really bothers Rock a lot because he builds the technologies that, shoot lasers based on where this is. So his argument was that if we could build a pro-am community that got a conversation around this, like how should we be contouring –
maybe it can improve medical practice. The other thing he found that was interesting, this is kind of anecdotal, was that a younger generation that grew up on 3D games was better able to kind of put together the body this way and think in 3D, and that was his other kind of impulse. So he believed that we could probably train a generation. If nothing else, if my one of our workers actually went in for some testing during this, and we were like, oh, yes, we would all play this game for 40 hours to be able to go in and read those images and say, hey, you know, you should think about this. So then the treatment obviously changes depending on this isn't good for patients at all. So imagine instead that you've got this diagnosis and multiple, instead of a second or third, a doctor's working with 2 million different opinions. One of the challenges to this work, I should say, is that because it's somewhere between health and science, is it NIH, you know, it's kind of hard to do. But this is Anatomy Pro-Am, and what we've been doing is building the sort of game architecture to do all of this work together. So we're imagining a game where the general public plays it, maybe kids and youth play it for science class, radiation doctor. Maybe along that curve I built, in school you're doing basic work, but if you want to play at home, you can go and keep playing. Medical professionals are already in that upward curve. So we built a single-player prototype, which I know I need to run through, that basically does this process where you have symptoms, you go to the doctor, you do imaging, you shoot up lasers, and would kids play it? The short answer is that, yes, they would play it. They liked it. It was interesting. I'll jump through this. So basically we found higher pre-post gains, which is not surprising because most kids don't know anything about cancer detection. But so I'll just kind of jump through this. But what we did from there was we started building an interface on Facebook that we used in medical classes with Lonnie Salkowski. Where is Lonnie? There she is, who teaches medical imaging and was saying that, look, what I want to do, and this is just a simple collaborative supportive tool. It's a very dumb tool. It's not doing a lot of design, but just simply letting them diagnose together and argue about where it is better than what they do. So this is just kind of a real simple, like, hey, yes, we will make that for you. From there, we built an anatomy browser that's currently available on the iPad that's meant to augment medical education, connect images to the body. So what you're seeing is where the scans are in a medical browser to help, and we get data based on what people do there that is meant to get more at the professional pre-med and medical professional community. Again, all toward building different interfaces toward this underlying data structure where we can somehow get there. And this is the kind of the work we're doing in the next couple of years, tackling it piece by piece. It's been a lot of fun, and this may wrap up, because we're finding people like DeVry Medical will buy this from us. So we're able to hopefully, at the same time, get this in the medical people's hands, get access to their data, and then get them to pay us to build more of it, if that makes sense. We're building some kind of virtual cadavers and things, and just things that looks kind of like contract work, but is actually for us a way to get at that professional side of it. They don't really know of our master plan, and that's okay. So two ways things kind of close on. In general, we think about going from safe sandboxes where it's not authentic, you're not doing science, but moving them toward authentic participation and starting where you're a consumer playing to where you're someone making things, making levels, making studies and things. The last thing is that there are a bunch of challenges. Some things that we think about a lot are how do we get sustainable and scalable? So how can we engage a marketplace, whether it be something like DeVry or iPad apps or things that can help augment things like government funding and get us going at a scale that we couldn't otherwise achieve. A couple other things. I think that I do want to, since I'm here, leave you on maybe two things. One, this learning analytics thing is obviously really big. One of my big fears is that we will develop a lot of very powerful analytic techniques of studying things that aren't very interesting. So these games are, you know, we can argue to what extent they're interesting or not, but they're probably more interesting than reading and doing multiple choice tests, which is really a lot, if you scratch beneath the surface, a lot of what's happening, particularly, I would argue, on the West Coast with this kind of work. So if anything, we're trying to push ourselves to being more, you can call it constructivist if you want, you know, but more ensuring that we're having people do complex tasks where they're doing creative problem solving. That's kind of our current mission, because, and then applying analytics to those tasks, because that logic, I think, is going to be very important. The last point maybe, and this is for the field, and this is like things like, since some of you are program officers, is that this is a slide I gave our community at AERA, a big education conference. One thing I really want to really push, and I hope you can push your people to do, is to be more open. So we did put Virulent out there. There are people in South America running studies with Virulent right now. That I don't think happens enough. I think that, you know, when I was a student at Indiana and wanted to do games, there's no way I could work with some of the other labs out there. We try to do that and be as open as possible, and I would encourage you to encourage your people to.
trying to share and aggregate data. So with our underlying data infrastructure, one of our goals, since we have five of our games, is to call, and we're starting to do this now actually this year under Matthew Berlin's direction, but calling our colleagues and saying, if we can get our data infrastructure together, maybe we can do a joint study where we actually see you've got a water quality game and you've got a water quality game, and can we artfully do things together so we can understand what they do well and what they don't, and then try to get kind of a field of data sharing. Now, this is not a new problem. We've all been trying this for like 20 years, but maybe we're at a point where the technologies will support it in a way that could build a more robust field. So those are things I would ask you to ask of us in your things like your RFP. So that's it. I think we have some time for questions. Sorry, I went a little long.
I have a sort of a comment. Mm-hmm. I'm actually really glad to see this because I was having a conversation with someone earlier about the fact that most of citizen science currently is actually citizen data gathering.
Absolutely.
That's very different than citizen science, and it's really, really nice to see someone in the group that's working towards actual citizen science and making citizens into scientists and engaging not just students but community members. And it's really cool to see people like the mayor engaged in conversations about science and local science and how transformative that can be. I guess I do have one small question, which is,
sure.
I know you talked a little bit about sort of the broadening participation sort of aspect. So have you had any other sort of experiences within more diverse communities in terms of engaging students? I really like the model going out and asking the kids what they're interested in making a game about, but have you done more of that, or Are you going to do that? We have.
So two quick things. If you need a citation for that idea, Ben Shapiro, the colleagues at Tufts, and David Hatfield wrote a paper where they make the argument that, yeah, mostly they're unpaid data collectors or analysts, right? So in the case of Folded, they're kind of analyzing things, and they're not. Yeah, so I share that. In terms of that, yes, we did a major project in Milwaukee with some of the community-based stuff, and it was interesting and sobering in many ways. One of the big things I just walked away, the average teacher in Milwaukee lasts about a year. So one thing that's really, yeah, it's about 9 to 11 months, and then they move to the suburbs or they quit. And so something that's interesting, and Chris Deedy, who's coming in the future, has done work in Milwaukee of the sort, one of the people who kind of discovered this. So I had this real wake-up call, and I was talking with the recording. It's like, oh, so next year, and they're like, oh, next year, two of these people will be here? And you're going, oh, my God, like just every year we're going to have to call people back. But the other thing that we found was that I'm a convert in that sense of using place-based education for two reasons. One is that there's usually a group, like with Lake Wingra, there's a Friends of Lake Wingra group that is not going away. So even if they call the class and said, we have this thing, we worked with an urban ecology center, is another one, say, class, you come here every year, you come here this week, this is how it works. Maybe that new teacher will keep using it. And I was shocked by being outside and just really connecting science to what's happening in their environment, we saw really big interest gains in that community. I would say as big as, say, games would be, just like, oh, this is what, you know. So one of the groups we worked with, we took them to Lake Michigan. About a third of the class in Milwaukee hadn't been to Lake Michigan, which I just couldn't believe. They were asking questions about the beach rocks, like, well, how do these, they were just fascinated, like, why are they so flat? And I grew up on Lake Michigan, so I'm thinking, oh, my God, this is just crazy. So I became a real advocate of that, and so a lot of what we try to do in our curricular work is that kind of thing of getting kids into their community. So, yeah, we have done a lot of that kind of work. One thing I should say about gender is that things like our biggest gains on that cancer game was with girls, and it's consistent with other findings that if science is presented in a social context toward doing real work in the world, that can help people. You do see that it can keep girls who start falling off right at that middle age level. Middle school age level, sorry.
My question is also along the lines of broadening participation, and this is new to me, so I'm really excited to learn about it. And I guess part of the question was answered in that you are still seeing the gain among the different demographics, but I noticed in the images that showed people in the game that there wasn't diversity. I don't know if there are other
IRB. Madison IRB won't let us take pictures of Madison students generally.
No, I'm talking about the characters.
Oh, the representations in games. Yeah. That's a great question. We had an argument about that, and we sided with – there was a lengthy argument, and we decided that in 1967 there were only white men scientists.
Oh, yeah. I got that.
The main character in that game is –
vaguely Asian, I would say, which I don't know. I mean, we played around with that and went with that. I should say we generally have a relatively broad depiction, although, yeah, certainly it's a fair kind of comment on that. And some of our other games, I will say that so the Saving Lake Winger game is a good example where we deal with it explicitly. So that lake is a microcosm of Madison. So if you go, and this is in the game, so there's a section where African Americans go fishing, a section where Mexican Americans fish, and a section where Hmong immigrants fish. And on it, we actually talk about the role of the lake in each community, which people are eating fish for recreation versus food. And the biggest game we got was this, there was a student who was Hmong, which is a Southeast Asian, you know, Native population, and we had a Hmong fisher person, and he started freaking out. He's like, oh my God, there's a guy in the game who's Hmong. I can't believe it. And we had that kid. I think we had a camera on him. It was one of those moments. Like, oh my God, this is too much. But we definitely saw, in terms of culturally relevant pedagogy, we saw in spades on that project. And we have, because of that, tried to bring it in explicitly and probably could do more of it. And certainly environmental issues, like, you know, environmental social justice and stuff would be a way to go. So, yeah. Is how I think about it. Yeah, no, thank you. Maybe we'll go here.
I'm very impressed by what you're doing. And your diagram of how there are different ways that people relate to games, mm-hmm. although it's not just a matter of one way being based on an earlier one, being based on an earlier one. My question starts with your slide about World of Warcraft.
All right.
Because the approach to education that we mostly see, and I manage some of these grants myself, others do in a variety of programs, is instruction-oriented. We know something. We want them to learn it, and to learn it well, intellectually, as well as just rote memorization. But it, not always, but often minimizes the exploration aspect. I have only received a couple of proposals over the years about how to use something like World of Warcraft or the dozens of other massively multiplayer online games as educational settings emphasizing exploration. And yet you can learn map reading, you can learn a lot of math, you can learn economics, maybe not biology, but sociology. There's a lot of anthropology in them if it were built into curriculum. And if I just give one other example, mm-hmm. the picture you showed was the entrance to Stormwind, mm-hmm. which is the chief.
All right, here we go. He knows. Yeah, he knows. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And when I held the first major scientific conference in World of Warcraft in 2008, we created a Horde Guild, which still exists, and my level 90 Horde character is in the Stormwind Cathedral now. But the point is, students, as a part of a curriculum, could set themselves their own difficult goals, how to get into Stormwind Cathedral, what you had to do to prepare to get there, learning, therefore, general cognitive lessons about planning, about alternatives, about how to come back from defeat, and other things that are a part of, I think, a science and engineering education.
Yeah.
So what's your comment about that other possible...
So my dissertation was on the Civilization series. I modded it and used it for teaching world history. At my own peril, I was told by some people, like, you're doing what? Like, that's not going to play well when you're on the job market. And I thought, well, I don't know. All right, it's different, though. And so I'm very, you know, open or sensitive to that. My instinct would be that there are also so many ways that that could go wrong in the sense of, so there are people who have done some of that. You know, there are teachers teaching with World of Warcraft, with Minecraft. Almost always I'm like, this is going to be horrible. And then there are actually some people doing it really well. And so maybe it would be interesting. Like right now, as one of the labs that would, I think, arguably pioneered that kind of research, you know, we're one of the groups that actually paid attention to commercial games when not many people were, we never saw a place where you could do that. And I think, so if we were to have that say supported something like NSF, figuring out what is the right kind of paneling process, how do you support, whether it be questions of supporting who is doing what already with those and understanding what's working and what's not. One thing I would like to see, I think, is the
the grassroots communities around things like Minecraft and the ways that some of them are using for things like electric circuits and so on, I think is a good place to go. But I guess my only caution would just, I'm thinking like an administrator, but I could almost see the headline, you know, NSF funding, World of Warcraft, whatever. And I could imagine it going bad. So figuring out how do you create the right structures for that to be a good thing, to me, would be some of the challenges, I think.
Well, it might be that they don't pass the school test, but they go on to found the Microsoft of the future or something like that.
Yeah.
But I think that what Kurt is meaning is that it's not so much what content can they learn from it, but what will they systematically learn from it. So setting it up so that they're not just playing, but they're systematically learning from it.
It is hard, and like I said, and systematically, and figuring out what role that's going to play in the curriculum and what time you do it. Yeah.
So whether we agree or not, this conceptual distinction between delivery of curriculum and instruction and other kinds of learning may be worthy of research exploration.
Absolutely. And one thing I'm jumping through, if you are curious, my wife, Constance, did a 2-year ethnography of, see if I can find the kids. I just want to find the kids. I don't know why.
I didn't mean to distract you from other things people were interested in.
No. This is, there was a version of this presentation that had a whole bunch more of this stuff. See if I can find it. Anyway, all right. Well, it's not, maybe I'm close. So, see, I'm hard not to jump. All right, forget it. So she ran a 2-year after-school program taking kids who were failing at school and then building curriculum experiences around World of Warcraft, literally. So she had them run their own guild, build their own guild charter. And the big thing that she found from that, and these were mostly kids of color. Many of them were involved in gangs. They were from the Janesville area. And to show their commitment, they literally drove to Madison every week, and they got up there. And what she, her big finding was that the more you tried to sink it into school and have it be like, okay, today we're going to learn writing, it utterly failed. But running an interest-driven community where they said, all right, what are you interested in? I want to do this. And then back-ending stuff in it to get that more systematic kind of learning. Because it is also entirely possible to play through that game and not play it as mindfully. But I'd be happy to keep talking about that over lunch or another time.
So I want to thank you very much. Thank you, everyone, for being here. And I want to remind you that from 2:30 to 4, you can come back here, play some of these games, and we'll have some reflective discussion, I believe, about how do you actually, some of these issues that are coming up, how do you actually make learning happen in the context of these games that are fun and sustain your engagement, and then how do you get the learning to happen. So come back from 2:30 to 4 to this room. We'd love to have you. Thank you very much. And the next one in this series is Chris Deedy on March 17th.
Your board level 90 part
3. Thank you. This concludes today's conference. All parties may disconnect at this time.